From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the Linux operating computer system, what it is, where it's going, and why you can get it for free. We talk with Glenn Moody. His new book is Rebel Code, Linux and the Open Source Revolution. Also, creating hip animated shows around characters that are very uncool. We talk with Mike Judge. He's the man behind the Fox show King of the Hill and also Beavis and Butthead, which aired on MTV in the 90s. King of the Hill just celebrated 100 episodes this Sunday. And Milo Miles remembers guitarist John Fay. He died last week at the age of 61. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Democratic fundraiser Beth Dozoritz has refused to testify before a congressional committee investigating former President Clinton's pardons. Dozoritz invoked her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
A House committee is looking into connections between donations to former President Clinton's Library Foundation and the last-minute pardon of fugitive billionaire Mark Rich. The committee subpoenaed Beth Dozoritz, a Democratic fundraiser and friend of Rich's ex-wife Denise. Dozoritz spoke to the former president at least twice in the weeks before the pardon, but Dozoritz says she will not respond to the subpoena, citing her Fifth Amendment privilege under the Constitution. Denise Rich, who contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Clinton campaigns, claimed the same privilege. The chairman of the committee, Indiana Republican Dan Burton, says the Fifth Amendment claims amount to stonewalling. Burton says the reason seems to be that the two women are hiding something. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
An independent study of voting in Florida's Miami-Dade County has concluded that Democratic candidate Al Gore would not have won a hand recount of votes. The study was commissioned by newspapers after the U.S. Supreme Court effectively prevented a hand recount, thus ending the election dispute and giving George W. Bush the presidency. A national accounting firm looked at all 60,000 undervotes in Florida, those that showed no presidential preference when counted by machine. The results from Miami-Dade showed that Gore would have posted a net gain of only 49 votes, even under the most lenient standard. Results from other counties are expected in the next few weeks. President Bush said he hopes the result will end the debate over the legitimacy of his presidency. A new report by the group Amnesty International finds that dozens of U.S. companies sell weapons and other equipment that are used overseas to torture people. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
The items involved range from old-fashioned leg irons to high-tech electroshock weapons. The report says some 80 American firms are involved in the manufacture, export, and sale of the products abroad. It's illegal to own some of the equipment in the United States, but the report says the Commerce Department has granted licenses for sales abroad, totaling nearly $100 million in the past 3 years. The merchandise is sold under a category called crime control equipment, and major recipients are located in Russia, Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, Egypt, and Israel. Although many of the items could be used for legitimate law enforcement purposes, an Amnesty International spokesman says the group believes some of the products, such as flesh-tearing thumb cuffs and a shock-emitting belt, are inherently cruel, and so their export should be banned. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 200 points, or 1.9%, to close at 10,642 in active trading of more than a billion shares. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court has rejected a challenge to regulations in South Carolina that critics claim make abortions more difficult to obtain in the state. The court declined without comment to review the 27 pages of requirements for South Carolina clinics that had been challenged as costly, burdensome, and medically unnecessary. The regulations also require that clinics give state inspectors access to patients' medical records. In Austin, police have canceled the city's Tuesday night Mardi Gras parade after dozens of people were injured in disturbances over the weekend. Janet Heimlich reports.
The problems began Saturday night when a crowd of about 100,000 people gathered on Austin's Barline 6th Street to celebrate Mardi Gras. Things got ugly as partygoers threw beer bottles and smashed windows. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. One observer called what happened a stampede situation. 31 people were injured, including a police officer. 35 were arrested. The Austin Police Department has issued a statement saying it was canceling the Mardi Gras parade for the protection and safety of Austin's residents. The melee marks the latest problems along the popular five-block section of the downtown area. Four recent stabbings have occurred there. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
New fighting is raging in Burundi, even as regional leaders are meeting in neighboring Tanzania to try to revive the peace process and bring an end to the country's civil war. Former South African President Nelson Mandela is said by one diplomat to be ready to quit his mediating role out of frustration over the lack of progress in the talks. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. While Bill Gates was making billions of dollars off Microsoft's operating system, Windows, a group of renegade programmers were furiously working on a competing operating system that, when completed, would be given away for free. In 1991, a programmer in Finland named Linus Torvalds wrote the final piece of software, a program he called Linux. Torvalds is part of what is known as the open source movement. In addition to believing that computer software should be given away for free, they also include the source code for their program so that others can adapt and improve it. Over the past 10 years, as this free operating system has been rewritten and refined, it's been adopted by more and more parts of the industry, and it's beginning to challenge Microsoft's dominance. There's a new book about Linux and the open source movement called Rebel Code. Terry Gross spoke recently with its author, British journalist Glyn Moody.
What is Linux?
Linux is, strictly speaking, part of an operating system being the main control software that you find on computers. Most people, though, use the name Linux to refer to the whole operating system. But strictly speaking, this should be called something like GNU Linux, because it's harder to say. People tend to shorten it to Linux.
And what is the GNU part?
Well, the GNU part, if you like, is the other 90% that goes to make up an operating system. That the Linux, if you like, is the heart. It's strictly speaking called the kernel, and it sits, if you like, in the middle of a great tapestry of software. And that whole tapestry consists of other programs plus Linux. And the other programs have been written by a group of programmers who subscribe to what's called the GNU project.
And we should start with something really basic, which is, what is an operating system?
Okay. When you get your computer, it's basically a piece of metal with plastic and other sort of items in it, but it doesn't do anything until you put some software on it. And at the most basic level, you have to have an operating system which acts as a kind of housekeeper. It looks after the disks when they spin, it puts things up on the screen when you look at it, and it takes things from the keyboard. So all those basic tasks are handled by an operating system. And then on top of that, you will add what are called application programs, which do more specific tasks like word processing or accessing the internet.
What are some of the fundamental differences between the Linux system and, say, the Microsoft system?
Well, you can answer that on two levels. For example, the Linux or the GNU Linux operating system is incredibly robust. Typically, people switch it on and leave it on for years and it never crashes, whereas anyone who's used Windows will know that crashes, unfortunately, are a rather more common experience. But there's a rather more interesting difference between the two systems, which is that when you buy Microsoft Windows from Microsoft, in fact, you don't buy it, you just get a license to use it. Moreover, you can't actually see what that thing is that you buy. You buy a huge string of zeros and ones, those binary digits. However, when you use Linux or GNU Linux, you actually get the software to keep. It's yours, and you can do what you like with it. Moreover, you can change it. You can look at the underlying lines of programming code, and you can add improvements, or you can convert it into something completely different. So there's a fundamental difference in approach between what Microsoft does and what the people who create Linux and other similar free programs do.
Now, this is what Linus Torvald wanted when he created Linux. He wanted to keep it a free system, and he wanted people to be able to revise it, to debug it, to improve it. Why did he want to keep it free and open to people who wanted to make changes?
Well, initially he just wanted people to use the program that he'd created, and he was happy for them to do that without paying him. However, he didn't want people turning it into a commercial product and getting rich when he didn't. So he thought it was fair that he would give it away, provided everybody else kept it free. But the magic was that when he did that and people started sending him suggestions on improving it, and he incorporated those suggestions, his Linux started getting better and better, and he realized that what he'd stumbled upon was a completely new way of writing software, which is that you throw it open in the most general way possible, inviting people to submit their own improvements, and lo and behold, it does get better.
So what was Torvald's approach to preventing other people from making money on the system that he was offering for free?
Well, his initial approach was fairly crude. It just said, if you use this software, you may not make money out of it. And he had a very kind of rough and ready license. But then later on, he adopted something called the GNU, General Public License. And what this is a rather more formally thought out alternative licensing approach, which was first created by somebody called Richard Stallman, who is one of the other key figures in this world. And he specifically wanted to frame a different kind of license that, instead of taking away the rights of users, actually enshrine them. In other words, whereas when you buy software, as I say, you don't actually buy it, you just buy certain rights, which are very circumscribed. But with the GNU GPL, you are actually given rights. Moreover, you have to pass those rights on. So it's a kind of topsy-turvy license. And in fact, it's sometimes known as copyleft, in contradistinction to copyright.
And tell us more about what the license says.
Well, it basically tries to formalize the magic which people like Linus and Richard Stallman himself discovered in this sort of open source way of programming. In other words, if you release something under this particular license, you have to provide the underlying lines of programming code, which, as I said, is not what was done initially. Normally, you are presented with effectively a black box when you get software. You can't see inside how it works. But under the GNU GPL, you must provide the lines of source code, as it's called, the programming code. And in a way, that's providing the keys to the magic, and it's letting people see how things are done. And that was a real sort of breakthrough conceptually, because it was the antithesis of what had been done before. Now, paradoxically, you can actually sell this free software, provided you also make it available free as well. In other words, you have the freedom to sell it, but you must also provide it free. And this really forms the basis
You have the freedom to sell it, but you must also provide it free?
That's right.
Explain that contradiction.
Okay. In other words, you can package it in such a way that people might want to pay you money for it. So, for example, you could put it on a CD, you could provide manuals with it, you can sell it through, I don't know, computer magazines, for example. But you must provide a copy somehow that people can get hold of for free. And typically you would do that by placing a copy on the internet so people can download that copy. Moreover, if they buy your program, they also have the right to copy it and give it to their friends, unlike what you tend to find in the commercial world.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about the open source movement and another character in that movement, Richard Stallman, who is behind GNU. Tell us who Richard Stallman is.
Richard Stallman is a very remarkable individual in that he more or less started this single-handed back in 1984. He was one of the gifted young programmers at MIT during the 1970s, and he was happily sort of programming away when various events caused his, if you like, Eden of programming to disappear, in that all of the fellow programmers disappeared and they went to work for companies. The machine that he was using was taken away because it was getting old-fashioned. And he was so sort of deeply struck by this particular event that he resolved to single-handedly, if need be, create again this paradise that he'd enjoyed. And the way he was going to do that was by writing his own complete operating system, which is what this GNU is. And so back in 1984, he started piecing together, tiny part by tiny part, this entire operating system. And what's interesting is that he almost finished it, but there was one big piece missing, which is this so-called kernel. And it just so happened that Linus in Finland was creating just that missing piece in the early 90s. And when you put those two together, the GNU and the Linux, you get this complete free operating system that Richard Stallman has been striving for since 1984.
Well, you mentioned a little bit about his motivation for wanting to keep his system free. What were Stallman's other motivations for wanting to keep the system free?
Well, it's important to note that he uses the word free in the sense of freedom, not in the sense of costing nothing, because remarkably, he sees free software as an instrument of liberation. In other words, he thinks that by releasing free software to people, he increases their liberty. And really, this is a facet of his very strongly held beliefs in terms of empowering people. So he sees it almost as a political act.
Is he concerned about people co-opting his software?
He was very concerned about it, which is why he invented the GNU GPL that we talked about earlier, because this makes it impossible to co-opt. But you're absolutely right. That was the danger, that he would create this wonderful software and somebody would come and say, thank you very much, I'm now going to sell this for $1,000. So he spent a lot of time talking to lawyers and came up with this truly innovative document, because, as I say, in effect, it turns conventional licensing on its head to ensure that his creations would remain free for all people for all time.
When a system like Linux is not only free, but the source code is available to anyone who wants access to it, does it make it easier for somebody with the know-how to sabotage the Linux system?
Well, there are two schools of thought on this. Those who come from the more traditional software background indeed say that this makes it extremely vulnerable to people infiltrating the software and to including malicious programs. But those who are, if you like, more attuned with the whole open approach point out that if the software is open, then you can more readily spot any problems with it. And indeed, that's been shown the case over the last few years when many commercial programs have been found to have so-called backdoors, in other words, hidden capabilities that nobody knew about, and there was no way end users could ever find out about them. Similarly, some of these free programs have had problems found too, but they've been found before they've been exploited.
Glenn Moody's book about Linux is Rebel Code. We'll hear more of Terry Gross's interview with him after the break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Glenn Moody. He writes about computers and is the author of the new book, Rebel Code, Inside Linux and the Open Source Revolution.
Okay, so we've talked about two very bright, very creative people who have made very important systems available for free, Richard Stallman and Linus Torvald. What do they do to make money?
Well, they are a complete contrast in that respect. Linus Torvald is very much a pragmatist, and he actually works for a company which makes proprietary devices. It's called Transmeta. It's down in Silicon Valley. And interestingly enough, they've come up with a way of producing a chip which is essentially compatible with the Intel chip family. And Linus has been very involved with this. It's interesting to note that it's not directly involved with Linux. And I think the reason for that is his primary motivation for most things is the challenge. And he wanted to do something that was really quite different from what he'd already done in the preceding 10 years. So he is an engineer. He has the standard stock options, which have made him quite a wealthy man. He is married. He has three children. He drives quite a fast car. So he is sort of Mr. Normal in that respect. Richard Stallman, by contrast, doesn't work. That's to say, he devotes all of his time to programming to a lesser extent, and nowadays more to promoting and evangelizing his ideas. And he's able to do this in part because he was the winner of a so-called MacArthur Genius Prize some years ago, which gave him a sizable lump of money which he has invested to give him that freedom. So he is the antithesis in some respects of Linus, who is much more worldly.
A lot of our listeners will never have used the Linux system. What kind of computers does Linux operate on?
Well, the Linux kernel and the GNU Linux operating system runs on practically every computer that there has ever been, from the mightiest IBM supercomputer down to the Palm Pilot. Because one of the things that the people who create this software really enjoy is a challenge. And one of the greatest challenges is what's called porting, which is taking the GNU Linux system and making it work on new hardware. And therefore, there are people at this very moment who are creating new versions of GNU Linux to run on just about any computer system you can name. However improbable, they regard that as a challenge to be met.
Do you think at this point in the history of GNU Linux that the only people who can successfully use it are people who really understand the source code and who are computer experts and experts in computer language?
I don't think you have to understand the source code, but I think it is fair to say that you need to have a fair degree of computer expertise. And the reason for that is the power of this kind of software derives in great part from its flexibility. But as we know, flexibility can be a problem for people who don't want flexibility. And I think that it's going to be a few years before you see GNU Linux systems turning up regularly on the desktop. But it's important to remember that 3 or 4 years ago, people said, well, you'd never find GNU Linux in business, whereas the latest market research indicates quite clearly that it is already the second most important operating system after Windows. And just recently, Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, said to an analyst meeting that he regards Linux as the most serious threat to his company. So it has progressed from something that nobody took seriously in companies to being the most serious threat to Windows in companies. And I think the same will happen in due course, perhaps in 4 or 5 years' time on the desktop too.
Now, Linux is a free system, but IBM and Hewlett-Packard are now working with Linux. What are the relationships between Linux and these, you know, very corporate, very profit-making companies?
Well, it's certainly been a very interesting and important development. Last year, IBM announced a massive vote of support for Linux, and this year I think they've announced they'll be investing $1 billion in supporting Linux further. Now, clearly, they don't do this out of altruism. And the reason they're doing this is because it solves a major problem for them. If you look at the IBM line of hardware, they have supercomputers, they have what are called mainframes, the very big pieces of iron that do the main sort of number crunching. They have mini computers, they have PCs. And hitherto, those have all been completely incompatible. It was very difficult to get them to talk to one another. It was impossible to get one program that ran on one to run on another. Now, along comes GNU Linux, which they are porting, in other words, transferring to all of their hardware. What happens now? If you write a program that runs on your PC running GNU Linux, that same program will run on a mini computer, that same program will run on a mainframe, it will even run on a supercomputer. You don't need to change a line of code. So, at a stroke, it unifies their product line.
Has IBM and Hewlett-Packard found a way to make money on Linux, or are they just using Linux to make their own operation easier?
Well, they're certainly using it to make their operation easier. They're also using it, quite frankly, for tactical reasons, because anything that is a problem for Microsoft is clearly an advantage for them. But there are sound business reasons why they should back it, because IBM in particular was moving increasingly towards a service revenue model rather than producing hardware, rather than producing just software. In other words, you effectively give somebody the razor and then you sell them the razor blades on top. And what this amounts to is giving them the software, in other words, GNU Linux, and then providing plenty of consultancy, plenty of support. In fact, all those things which hitherto Linus and all his brilliant programmers haven't provided. So in fact, there's a wonderfully complementary relationship between the open source movement and big companies like IBM and HP and Compaq, who can now provide those things which were absent from the early days of the open source movement.
Like service, so that if something goes wrong, there's an expert you can call in from a company.
Exactly.
And they'll help you fix it.
You provide 24/7 backup. In other words, every hour of every day, somebody will be on call. And hitherto, that hasn't been available, and people have used that against open source, saying, well, the software's all very well, but what happens when it goes wrong? Who do I call? The answer is you call IBM, you call HP, you call Compaq. And they're finding that there are good revenues to be made there.
Do you think that the Linux system is a threat to Microsoft? Now, I ask that. I know the judge in the Microsoft antitrust case, Judge Thomas Penfield, didn't seem to think that it was, and he said there weren't any viable alternatives to Windows. He also said that Linux was a fringe operating system that's unlikely to challenge Microsoft.
Well, with all due respect to the judge, I think that was true 3 or 4 years ago, but it manifestly isn't true now. I've already quoted what Steve Ballmer said. I mean, if he says it is the main threat to Microsoft, he is not a man to exaggerate. The market research reports make it quite clear that the GNU Linux system is rapidly catching up with Windows in the server field. It's true that on the desktop, as I said before, GNU Linux still has a long way to go, but it will get there. It has this sort of slow, steady progress. So I think it already is a very serious threat. And it's very interesting that just recently, one or two Microsoft executives have started suggesting that perhaps Linux has peaked and perhaps it won't be around much longer. Now, this is a dramatic change from their previous stance, which was that nobody was using it and therefore it didn't really matter. So I think that their actions speak louder than words in the sense that they are clearly worried.
Would the Linux system be strong against that attack if it caught on?
Because everybody's Linux system is different. Everybody can tweak it.
Because people personalize it, right.
That's right.
And they customize it.
And also, for example, you wouldn't just have one email client. There is no Outlook for Linux. There are sort of 10 different ones. And therefore, when the virus arrived on your PC running Linux, it wouldn't know what to do because it couldn't assume that you had one program.
There seem to be two extremes in the software movement. On the one hand, you have people who become gazillionaires because they write programs that are so successful. And on the other hand, you have the people in the open source movement who write wonderful programs, but they think that the programs should be free. Is there any middle ground?
I mean, I suppose there is, but I think that contrast is important because personally what I see is that free software and open source represent a contrast to the whole kind of dot-com philosophy that we've seen over the last two or three years, and which I think now a lot of people are regarding as discredited, this kind of at all costs, get rich quick and just worry about the IPOs. I think people are starting to realise that that perhaps isn't what life is about. And the values inherent in the open source and free software world, the values of sharing, the values of generosity, I think are going to make a comeback. And in many ways, my book is about the next phase, if you like, within the computer world.
Well, Glenn Moody, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Glenn Moody's new book is Rebel Code, Inside Linux and the Open Source Revolution. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Milo Miles remembers guitarist John Fay, who died last week. Also, the creator of King of the Hill and Beavis and Butthead, we meet animator Mike Judge. Last night, King of the Hill celebrated its 100th episode. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. There was a time in the mid-90s when many parents considered Mike Judge public enemy number one. Judge was the man behind Beavis and Butthead, two trash-talking, metal-rock-worshipping cartoon characters who were stars of MTV programming and later of a hit feature film. After the Beavis and Butthead series on MTV ran its course, Judge pitched a new idea for an animated series, this time to the Fox network, about a conservative-minded, decent, and utterly uncool guy who lives with his family in a small town in Texas and faces the bewildering twists of modern culture with the help of his trio of misfit pals. King of the Hill premiered in January 1997. Over the course of 100 episodes, Hank Hill has had to deal with his wife Peggy's bid to become state boggle champion, his live-in niece's conversion to fundamentalism, and his son Bobby being picked by Buddhist priests to be the next Dalai Lama. In 1999, the show won an Emmy for Outstanding Animated Program. Here's a clip from the 100th episode of King of the Hill, which aired last night. Hank's wife, Peggy, has invited the new scantily clad sexy young receptionist, Tammy, from Hank's office to stay with them, much to Hank's dismay. In this scene, Hank's friends are asking him about Tammy.
Hang on a sec!
That Tammy's quite a dish. Frankly, though, I think my Nancy has a nicer can. Hank, do you think Nancy has a nicer can than Tammy's can? Huh? My wife's can vis-a-vis your wife's friend's can?
Stop it, Dale. It's bad enough I have to live with her now, running around the house in those mini skirts. That pager never stops beeping, and I've had it up to here with her coming in all hours of the night.
How do my girls look, Hank?
I wouldn't know.
Mike Judge, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What I really like about Hank Hill is that he's this conservative guy trying to make sense of things and treat people with humanity in a world that is just has gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what's fun is to have the world be wrong and Hank be right, you know, even though he's not king of the world, he's maybe king of his block.
Hank's pals are really a wonderful trio. One's an exterminator consumed by conspiracy theories. Another's a barber in the army with very low self-esteem. And then there's Boomhauer, who you also supply the voice for. And he's kind of this rockabilly type, and he's known for being completely unintelligible. Can you do some Boomhauer for us, for people who are not familiar with his garbled speech?
Yeah, Boomhauer, I'd wanted to do an animated character like this for a while whose accent was so thick that you couldn't follow him. Because I'd known, there's a guy I knew in Dallas that, especially after he'd been drinking, you kind of knew what he was talking about, but you didn't know what he was saying. And it's also based on a guy who called to complain about Beavis and Butthead, who left a voice message.
That got replayed and replayed in
that I listened to
in the studio.
Yeah, and he was, I don't know if you can say this on NPR, but you could bleep it out, I guess. He thought the name of the show was Porky's Butthole. I don't know how he got that out of Beavis and Butthead, but his phone call, he was saying, I've been calling y'all a bit of mutt now, grab about y'all every time them dang old pokey freaking old butthole come on. And y'all been jobbing them on dang old commercials on and on every time like y'all do last time, you know. Uh-huh. And I was calling a guy for directions once in Oklahoma City and got a Boomhauer kind of guy who's just, so, hey, yeah, you know, come on that on that old patch, you know, coming on the off-ramp, and you turn around and it's going to be right there, you know. And so that's, you know, that sort of thing. He's also, like, I think Boomhauer, I think of him as, like, if he had grown up in Southern California, he probably would have been a surfer for life, you know, and he's one of those guys everybody likes. He doesn't say much, but girls like him and guys like him, you know, he's kind of good-looking guy, kind of mysterious.
How has the series changed or developed in 100 episodes?
a lot of the characters have developed in a really good way. You know, it's taken on a life of its own, and it's all through just, you know, it's a big collaborative process. There's writers, and I think the voice actors actually have a lot to do with it. Peggy has developed into one of my favorite characters. When in the beginning, it was one of those things where I wasn't quite sure, you know, like, what do we do with her? And I'm not great with female characters anyway. And it just kind of happened. It takes on a life of its own, and it's a grand sum of all the people who are working on it, really.
Peggy is wonderful. She's a boggle champion. She has a lot of skills under her belt. She's a real feminist, too. Self-actualized,
yeah.
Even though she lives in Arlen, Texas.
Yeah. Actually, when Greg Daniels came onto the project after I'd done the first draft of the pilot, that was one of the things, you know, I was saying, help me out with this. I can't figure this character out. And what he did, he started asking me questions about, he's like playing psychologist. He said, okay, describe your mother. And my mom was actually a Spanish teacher in high school and a substitute for most of the time I was growing up. And my grandmother, she had a degree in Spanish, but she's from Montana. She was always writing, and she got published like in Atlantic Monthly, but they were all very kind of like, she got published as this mountain woman, you know, who's writing about they were homesteaders, you know, up in Montana, her family. And so we just kind of started talking. So a lot of that stuff made it into the show. I mean, Peggy's from Montana in King of the Hill, and she's a substitute Spanish teacher. And I should probably be careful what I say here. My mom may be listening. But I mean, it's not, my mom's actually very different because she pronounces Spanish perfectly and Peggy Hill pronounces horribly. She's probably closer to my grandmother.
You have kind of an eclectic background. You were a physics major in college. You worked as an engineer. And then you also performed in bands. How'd you get interested in animation?
Well, I've always been interested in animation since high school. And I guess I was just too much of a wuss to actually commit to it ever and to really try to, you know, like I... In college, I just thought, well, you know, I don't want to waste 4 years of tuition on a film degree or something, you know, because it just seemed like back then it was all science. You know, if you ever want a job, you've got to have a science degree, and math and physics came fairly easily to me, and so I did that. But you know, I mean, in the back of my mind, my pipe dream was always to go into comedy in some way. But I knew I couldn't be a stand-up comedian or anything. But you know, I wanted to write and do this and that. But you know, how do you do that? I had no idea how you become one of the guys on Second City TV or Saturday Night Live or anything. And so I finally got the idea to do animation. I just thought, well, when I realized that one person can animate like a 2-minute short, it just takes you like 6 or 7 weeks to do. But then I thought, wow, this is something I can do on my own. I don't need anybody. I don't need to get a bunch of people together and try to do sketches or something. It just took me a while to realize that. But I had always been interested in it, and I've always done imitations and done drawings since high school.
So your first film was a short about office work.
Yeah. I did a short called Office Space. This character Milton and his boss. I just shot it on my Bolex. I went to the place to transfer your home movies to video for like $14, and then I put the sound on just on this U-Edit video place in Dallas, and just mailed it out. Just got in numbers out of information like for Comedy Central, MTV, and just amazed that I just started getting calls back. I didn't think it would. I was thinking, God, I should have done this when I was 20, you know. I was like 27 at the time.
Were you writing from what you knew? What kind of office had you worked in?
Yeah, that was based on a sort of loosely based on... I'd worked my first engineering job. I only had two, and the second one didn't last very long. But I worked at a... it was actually in San Diego. What was the place? It was called SSAI. Great name for a company.
Catchy.
Yeah. SSAI. And there was a guy there that I had, seemed like no one ever talked to him. He's sitting, for some reason I was bored. I just thought, okay, I'm just going to talk to this guy. I won't say what his name was. It was not Milton, but it was something else. I just said, hey, how's it going? And he just launched into this long thing about, he was saying, if they move my desk one more time, I'm quitting. And I used to be over by the window, and they made me move three times already this year. And he was just so angry. Like, this guy who I'd never talked to, had never heard a peep out of, and I just said, how's it going? And I got this long rant.
Mike Judge is the co-creator and executive producer of Fox's animated primetime series, King of the Hill. He's also the voice of Hank Hill. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mike Judge. He's the executive producer and co-creator of King of the Hill, the animated series on Sunday nights on Fox. King of the Hill has an interesting look to it. It's not as flat or two-dimensional as a lot of animated series. And I sometimes, looking at the backgrounds, they do all look hand-drawn to me. Are they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's this misconception out there that everything's done on computers, and it's not. I mean, King of the Hill is all done hand-inked and painted on cel, and the backgrounds are all... I think what you're talking about, what actually makes the show look different, this was a decision I made early on, was to have to use watercolors on the background. I can't paint watercolor at all myself, but we, you know, it's what we hire people for. And, so, yeah, it's watercolored backgrounds with, you know, nice shading. And even if a show is done digitally inked and painted, is what they call it, still somebody has to draw it. Somebody has to draw everything, unless it's something like Toy Story. Everything is, every frame you see is a drawing. And especially on King of the Hill and The Simpsons also, as well as Beavis and Butthead, are all hand inked and painted on the cel.
Do you write jokes for King of the Hill? One-liners, gag lines?
Well, I personally don't like doing that. And a lot of times we end up having that, and I'm always the guy who kills it, you know? The reason a lot of sitcoms go bad is they kind of deteriorate into every character becoming a smart aleck. Because I think that's just easier to write than to come up with situations where the comedy comes out of just, you know, the characters and observational kind of things, you know. That's actually like I guess it's because normal people in everyday life aren't constantly saying smart aleck comebacks that it took a Harvard Lampoon guy 3 hours to come up with, you know. It breaks the reality of it, and I just don't like that. I lose interest in shows where some, you know, 14-year-old hot-looking underwear model girl says, yeah, the last time you brushed your teeth, there were 5 more communist countries in the world. You know, it's just like, I just don't care about those kind of characters, so...
That's funny, though, to imagine you killing all these jokes. Does your heart ever sink? At least I should leave one in.
Not usually. Once in a while, if it's To me, if it's funnier than it is unrealistic, then it's okay. And because I've, you know, but on Beavis and Butthead, there was one, I remember this, I guess, just because there was a journalist in the room who wrote about it, where somebody had written Beavis saying, yeah, that guy, he's going to have Beavis envy, like a penis envy joke. And I just thought, no, Beavis is not going to, Beavis isn't that clever.
Let's talk about Beavis and Butthead. For people who don't remember, they were a sensation on MTV, yeah, I think over seven seasons in the early 90s.
Something like that. The seasons were, we do two a year sometimes, so who knows. Yeah, early 90s to, went off the air in, I want to say 97, yeah, November 97.
They were quite repulsive 14-year-olds who sat on a couch in front of the TV and made fun of everything. They also ventured forth once in a while to work part-time at a burger joint. I want to play this clip from an episode called Blackout because it has one of my favorite made-up names for a TV drama series, Asbestos in Obstetrics, starring Melissa Gilbert.
Hey, Butthead, what is asbestos?
It's like health food or something.
Oh, yeah.
Tell the commissioner we need that helicopter. I don't care what it costs. No, I'm not chipping in.
This sucks. Huh? Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Hey, Butthead, what's wrong with the TV?
I don't know. Let's kick it.
Yeah, let's kick it. Let's kick it.
That's from Beavis and Butthead, which aired on MTV in the 90s, produced and created by my guest, Mike Judge. And Mike Judge also was the voice of Beavis and Butthead. Who were these guys? Where'd you call them?
It started out as drawings in my sketchbook, and I'm not sure what I was going for. I hated being 14 and being in junior high, and I remember thinking around that time that I drew them that there are 14-year-olds kind of looked the same then. This was like 1990 or whatever that they did as they did when I was in high school. They were still wearing AC/DC t-shirts, and my high school reunion had actually just happened, and a friend of mine was talking about this guy I knew in high school who's actually very different from Beavis and Butthead. He was a straight A student, but he kind of had a spastic laugh that was it was a little deeper than Beavis. He was always sitting at front of the class, kind of sucking up to the teacher all the time and laughing at everything the teacher would say, and his laugh was kind of and so I made two attempts at drawing him. I actually tried to draw him like four times, and none of them looked like him, but a couple of them became Beavis and Butthead. But I guess they're kind of like, I don't know, they started out as being completely repulsive characters, definitely. I mean, that was the point, completely moronic. The way I think of it, in the beginning anyway, was I remember... I'm always struck by how out of touch it seems that people in entertainment and in the news are. And I remember hearing one of these statistics you always hear, like 80% of high school kids in some town couldn't locate the United States on a globe if it wasn't marked. And, you know, the news reporter was shocked. I wasn't that shocked. I was, and, you know, I mean, because I remember junior high and I... And so to me, they're like that 80%, you know.
The thing that a lot of people liked about Beavis and Butthead was that they were really stupid, but they'd sit there and they'd watch TV, they'd watch American popular culture, and they'd know it was so stupid.
Yeah, that's what was really fun, was to have, like, also I think when you, sometimes if you free your mind of intellectual matters, a lot of truth can come out that... That just comes out from some gut level, and that's fun, you know. And it was also like, actually, very early on when MTV first bought it, they showed my original shorts to a focus group and sent me a tape of it. And right before mine, the tape had, you know, it's a, like a one-way mirror. You're looking at like 14 mall rats just sitting there watching stuff, you know. It was really funny. They'd show them something like Aeon Flux, which is this really intricate, this Japanese animation style, real, you know, they'd show them really artsy stuff, and these kids would just go, well, that was dumb. And there's something really funny about that, that, you know, everyone's efforts, you know, making these videos and all these kind of high concept things, and the just the reality that the real audience is a couple of 14-year-olds just going, you know. So, by the way, that wasn't the butthead laugh. That was my own laugh right there.
thanks for clarifying.
That was my own dumb laugh.
You do a lot of the writing, and you're doing the voices on King of the Hill, but you're pretty affluent by now, after all is said and done. Is there a place you go, like the local bar, to, you know, keep your ear fresh?
Well, I can always go to Home Depot, hang out there, get some inspiration. I have a thing about grocery stores. I like going to the grocery store. I don't know, grocery stores are like, it's like when I saw Breakfast at Tiffany's and she's talking about how nice it is in the jewelry store, I thought, yeah, that's how I feel about grocery stores. You know, it's all this food, it's all, they try to make it a nice environment, and it really is, so. and the grocery stores in New York always smell like rotten meat, but down here they, in Texas and L.A., they, I don't know, somehow they managed to make them smell nice. But I got sidetracked there. I actually, the neighborhood I live in Austin is, yeah, it's pretty affluent, but not so much that, it's one of those typical things that's happened in the suburbs where there's, like, brand new houses, and then the old hillbilly guy who's lived there forever is right next door to me. And, so I still, you know, I just put gas in my car, go to the grocery store, go to Home Depot. It's not, you know, it's still, it's not like I'm in a castle somewhere. And Austin is, although it's not a typical Texas town at all, parts of it are, you know. It's, parts of it are, you know, there's also lots of artists and filmmakers and musicians, but there's also regular people there, too.
Which character on King of the Hill is most like you?
Probably Hank. I mean, people, friends of mine have said that Hank's probably the closest of all the stuff I've done, including Beavis and Butthead, to me. Although my roommate in college insists that Butthead was the closest to me.
Mike Judge, co-creator and executive producer of King of the Hill, Fox's primetime animated series. It just aired its 100th episode last night. Coming up, Milo Miles remembers guitarist John Faye. This is Fresh Air. John Faye, a unique contributor to American guitar music, died last Thursday following heart bypass surgery.
He was 61. Over the course of his career, Fay inspired both New Age music and noisy rock bands with his combination of blues, folk, Indian ragas, musique concrète, and outright free improvisation. Our music critic Milo Miles has this tribute.
John Fahey thought of the guitar as a time machine, a spaceship, a thing that makes noise, anything but the tame guardian of folk culture that many of his peers preferred. Fahey sometimes indulged his blues scholar side or noodled around with electronic experiments, but his best work sought the mysterious beauty and the lurking fear and rage of the old blues and bluegrass records he heard in the 1950s. He started a whole school of solo acoustic guitar that he liked to call American Primitive, though his most famous disciple is the virtuoso Leo Kottke. Fahey made a Christmas record called The New Possibility, which remains a reliable seller, but most of his albums stayed on the fringes of music, where Fahey felt as comfortable as he could anywhere. After an unhappy childhood in Tacoma Park, Maryland, Fahey ended up in and around Los Angeles in 1964. In that period, he helped rediscover country blues masters Skip James and Bucca White. He was already playing his own unclassifiable music for his own independent label, Tacoma Records. Fahey would get on stage with a quart of Coca-Cola, a fifth of whiskey, and sometimes a big tortoise he would let crawl around, and the hippies wouldn't know what to make of him. Fahey sold Tacoma in 1981 and was laid low for years by illness and alcohol. He rebounded in the 1990s with the fine introductory collection, The Return of the Repressed. He was embraced by the outsider culture of indie rock, and his last albums are too loosey-goosey avant for their own good. Still, nobody balanced form and phantasmagoria like Fahey when he was on, in albums like The Great San Bernardino Birthday Party and Death Chants, Breakdowns, and Military Waltzes. Fahey is best understood as a type of American religious ecstatic, and his finest albums transcend the death that always obsessed him.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel in stories by debut author Justin Cronin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, jazz pianist Keith Jarrett. We feature an encore presentation of our interview with him. Join us for the next Fresh Air.